Welcome to Healthcare and Hire, a podcast for healthcare professionals and aspiring healthcare executives looking for information, association, and inspiration from higher-level leaders across the healthcare industry. I'm Iqbal Acha, career consultant, healthcare recruiter, and registered pharmacist. Every week, I sit down to interview healthcare executives, clinical leaders, medical entrepreneurs, and industry experts to learn how they got to where they are today, what they see as the future of healthcare, and what they're doing to make healthcare more accessible, affordable, and effective. Let's find out more about today's guest. Dr. Farhad Modarai is the Senior Vice President of Product Management for Strive Health. He is part of the Care Model team and oversees the development and growth of value-based care for patients with kidney disease. Dr. Modarai's professional experiences span various healthcare settings, including government, academia, and community. Before joining Strive Health, he served as an Associate Regional Medical Officer at CareMore Health, primary care physician at Duke University Health System, and epidemiology fellow for the CDC. Dr. Modarai earned his doctorate degree from the University of Medicine and Dentistry of New Jersey and has served on numerous boards, including the American College of Preventative Medicine and the North Carolina Academy of Family Physicians. Hello, Dr. Modarai. Welcome to the Healthcare and Hire podcast.
Hello, Iqbal. How are you doing?
Fantastic, sir. How about yourself?
Not too bad. And Farhad is fine.
Farhad, it is. It's an honor to have you on the show. I've seen you at a couple of conferences. You've been certainly making the rounds in terms of speaking and educating your audiences. And the work that you're doing at Strive Health is phenomenal, which we're going to dig into quite a bit. Why don't we take this opportunity and have you formally introduce yourself to the listeners? Tell us a little bit about who you are, what your role is, and how do you help take healthcare to a higher level?
Thank you so much, Iqbal, and really appreciate you reaching out, taking an interest, and wanting to just have a conversation. I'm a practicing primary care doc. I really pride myself on being a generalist overall, and I've been able to kind of carve a little bit of an interesting path for myself career-wise, kind of after residency, you know, diving into a healthcare side of the industry where not just focused on delivery care. So I look at it as the macroscopic and the microscopic. So microscopic being kind of the individual, what I'm doing with the patient at any given moment, but always had this interest of just trying to understand what's the environment, the policy, the ways that things are getting paid for, how the systems are run, what are the all the gears that keep the engine going. And so I've been lucky and fortunate for the last decade to kind of be in a position where I could have insight into both worlds. So started my career over at CareMore Health, which was a provider group that started as a provider group, but got purchased by a large health insurance company. And so really had a payer provider type of world and insight into how do we really think about aligning the incentives to deliver higher value for patients and for the care that we're delivering. And then found my way into kind of this other niche area that I would have never anticipated going into, value-based kidney care, which is kind of a new space that is cropping up. Where we're among a crop of tech-enabled companies that's really looking to disrupt kidney care and challenge the status quo here, and it's been an interesting ride so far. So, kidney care and value-based care is something that is coming off of the shoulders of what's been happening within the industry since the Affordable Care Act passed in 2009 now under the Obama administration. And it's kind of the latest, iteration of what we need to do to try to improve quality and access to care, but also bend that cost curve because it's just not sustainable. I was recently listening to a great podcast called Freakonomics, and they had a thing about dialysis as a test case for Medicare for All. And they had a stat in there about like dialysis cost right now for dialysis B for patients with end-stage kidney disease is one out of every 100 taxpayer dollars goes to pay for dialysis, which is insane if you think about it. It's 1% of the federal budget goes to paying for such a small percentage of people getting care. So it's definitely something that's we need to get a grasp over. And it's an exciting time to be in this space. So my role over at Strive is really focused on thinking about our clinical model, various aspects of how we deliver the care, and how do we really enable the aspects of the care with creating good workflows, creating equipping the right technology into data insights to drive how do we touch the right patient at the right time with the right intervention, that type of work. And so that's kind of the piece of where I've been able to kind of get in there right now. And so it's more thinking through, you know, what does it take to really scale the type of solutions to these problems. You know, we started off with one state. By the end of the year, we'll be across 22 states. We have urban, rural geographies, suburban geographies, commercial, Medicare, Medicaid. So how do you do this type of work for a variety of patients?
To be a part of an organization, a startup like this that has really tackled on 1% of the federal budget in a way that you've described it is pretty remarkable. And I do know that there are other companies that have moved into this space as well. But you know, one of the things that I find interesting about your organization, about Strive Health, is how quickly it has been able to leverage partnerships and really maintain its own mission and vision throughout the process. So when I take a look at what Strive Health has done, I know that the organization was founded in 2018. It has raised, I think, if I'm not mistaken, $220 million in funding over 2 years. I was under the impression that you guys were, supporting and helping patients in 12 states, but you're telling me 22. So that's even better. I mean, that's almost half of the country. Yeah, that's remarkable. By the end of the year, you'll be at 22 states. So we'll make that disclaimer. But I think that that's remarkable because, so far you've been able to actively manage and sure, the numbers are higher. But if research is correct, like you had actually had an active patient load of about 30,000 patients. Is that number still correct?
Higher. I think we're inching up closer to 45 to 50,000.
Wow. Yeah, that's great. And even in the last 12 months, I've been watching how Strive Health has developed new relationships with other parties and other payers. The partnerships that you've established very recently with NANI, the Nephrology Associates of Northern Illinois and Indiana, Conviva Health, Evolent Care Partners, even Humana and Nextgate, that tells me that the quality product, service, and delivery of what you are providing is attracting not just patient care, patient desire, but also primary care physicians, hospitals, payers, that they are looking for these solutions that are going to be able to deliver, patient outcomes at a high rate, but also to be able to ensure the quality is there as well, which I think is fantastic. And to boot, your company actually won an award, if I'm not mistaken, Comparably's Best Places to Work in the Denver area. I mean, these are little things that most people are like, oh yeah, we did that too. But in reality, when you think about all these good things, they become amalgamated and you start to think about, wow, what else do I not know? Which is why we've invited you to the show, because I think that you really have a phenomenal story as well. Being the senior vice president of product management, that's a relatively new role for you. And, you had mentioned before, you've been very fortunate or lucky or, strategic in terms of how you've positioned yourself to be at the right place at the right time. You were an associate regional medical officer at CareMore. You've been on the board for, if I'm not mistaken, the North Carolina Academy of Family Physicians, as well as the American College of Preventative Medicine. And if I'm not mistaken, you are still an associate faculty member at Duke University Health System. So you've got your fingers in a lot of pies, but that allows you to see so many good things and bring forward insights and share your role as well. let's talk a little bit more about what you do today at Strive Health. You know, the title Senior Vice President of Product Management for me is a little bit nebulous because I know some product managers, but you know, from a value-based kidney care model, that's kind of vague for me. Why don't we learn a little bit more about like what you and your team do, and then like maybe some recent successes that you have been proud of your team and yourself that you've been able to achieve, or an initiative that you are all currently working on and why that's important to Strive Health.
Yeah, thank you for being curious and digging into all these aspects of what Strive has done and really unpacking that. So my role now is an interesting one. I can't say I've been strategic on getting it. It's an area that we identified as a need as a startup, right? And being in a startup environment, things are changing so fast, and you need to be agile and nimble to really adapt to how do you really grow and scale a company. We just started in 2018. Here we are, fast forward a few years later, right? And we launched our first market April of 2020. So, I mean, a month after everything got locked down. So our entire care model, the design, all the work that went into, you know, we're going to do a lot of face-to-face, see patients, all of that came to a halt, right? When everything went locked down. And then, you know, early on in 2020, you start to think about, oh, this is only going to last a few months. Oh, this will only be, you know, so it's like you can't really have a very, like, a forward-thinking view of like, all right, we'll get back to our brick and mortar, beautiful brick and mortar place that we just built in St. Louis and start to see patients again. So, you know, standing up, just like many other healthcare organizations, standing up the ability to do virtual care overnight and pivoting aspects of a model. And then we just grew so fast. We just launched, you know, one new market after another. And we started to really realize that, wow, like there's still a desire, a need to grow. Demand is there. Health insurance companies really are putting out more RFPs for trying to identify a solution. They're seeing more and more. The 21st Century Cures Act that was passed under the prior administration has allowed end-stage kidney disease patients to enroll in Medicare Advantage plans. And that's the first time ever that patient is eligible for that. So, you know, health plans and other payer groups like Conviva, who are at-risk primary care groups, also are seeing rising membership with end-stage kidney disease, CKD. So the demand was there. And so we kept growing and scaling. And we realized that we need to really sit down and as we want to scale and grow effectively to manage rural populations, urban populations, we need to think about what we can easily scale, how we can go to market as fast as possible and still deliver high quality care. So it required a re-evaluation and refocus effort on what are our programs, our services, what can be centralized, how can we get operational rigor to grow as fast as we need to. And so that's kind of where this new product team came from. It was, we're looking at product as not like, an iPhone or an app or software. We're looking at products as our programs and our services. And then what is the technology, the data, the insights to enable those programs and services? So we built a team under me to really think about our transitional care management program. We're NCQA accredited for complex care management and population health. So there's a lot of rigorous things you have to do to ensure you're maintaining that higher quality of care for care management and accreditation. So what are those programs that look like? We have disease management programs where we have nurse practitioners really able to do the congestive heart failure, diabetes, hypertension management to help stabilize patients that have underlying kidney disease. You know, we have more of these specialized, you know, focused programs, things like optimal starts where we want to help patients that inevitably have to transition to dialysis, transition in the safest way that's possible. Transplant management. If you've ever been through or seen a patient go through a transplant evaluation process, it can be very complex. There's often a lot of procedures, tests, visits you have to get. There's a lot of follow-up, regular follow-up. Sometimes it can be months of a workup just to even be considered to be evaluated. So somebody needs to be tracking, you know, every step of the way. And then even one transplant center might have one criteria, another transplant center might have another. So how do you really sit down and think about, you know, enabling workflows to capture that? So this new role that stepped into, it's been a few months now, has really been a much more dedicated, focused effort around, let's look at our programs, let's look at our services, let's make sure we're getting regular, good feedback loop from the front lines as we're in the midst of it, what's working, what's not working, how can we fine tune and iterate, better doing workflows, better capturing, you know, the right data sources. And then, you know, we have a pretty robust data infrastructure. You know, we've done a ton of investment in our data platform. And, you know, we get linked up, our tech team is you know, able to get access to a whole host of lab data, a whole host of biometric data, patient capture data. We get plugged into state HIEs, ADTs. When we partner with health payers, we get their authorization, all their claims data. So we get all of this well-rounded data. We tag it to their one individual patient. We create our own kind of unique patient identifier. And then we have a data science team, like almost PhD level data scientists that we haven't bought a single off the shelf, you know, predictive analytic thing. Everything is in-house. So, you know, they're reading the latest studies and on machine learning and different types of algorithms, and then say, how can we make it even better? And then how can we make it specific to our population? You know, so like, again, a lot of the off the shelf, you know, if you look at just predictive analytics, if it's over a general Medicare population, you know, that doesn't really help us because we're not a general Medicare population or general population. All of our patients are late stage chronic kidney disease or end stage. So by the nature of the number of the patients that we have in our programs, they all have medical, social, clinical complexity. And so how we classify a low risk patient might be a very high risk patient if you run it into a off the shelf algorithm. So how do we now, you know, we have some of our predictive models have over 100 different inputs that go into it with machine learning that just get fine tuned over time. How do we take those homegrown insights and now embed it and enable the workflows that something I said earlier, really the right patient, the right time, the right intervention. So to have a dedicated team that's focused on those fine little details, how do we put these pieces together to ensure that it's seamless, is so critical. And so that's where it kind of organically came there. We had a core care model. We knew it was working, but it was hard to really sit down and say, all right, meaningfully, can we replicate this and scale this as fast as we need to, and without burning people out, right? So that's the key. And so that's been my focus. I feel like it's a very different, divergent path for me professionally. This is not something that I would have ever envisioned. And that's kind of the nature of my own kind of curiosity. If I saw, you know, something that maybe could have been addressed here or needs here. And so being able to sit down and think through, hey, how can we improve this? And that's, you know, the kind of philosophy I've adapted in life. And I feel like it's carved out really interesting pathways for myself. And then I got a great team that works with me. I have a very seasoned product, leader who knows the product world inside and out, and has the really good rigorous discipline around how do we do, you know, good user stories, acceptance criteria, and those things, and really, you know, partnering with him to deploy this new team, which has grown quite significantly. We're up to almost 20 something people on the team now. Really kind of getting in there and having folks create their own portfolios of different programs and services, and just kind of going in there with how do we keep getting better and enhancing what we do.
Farhad, you've not only surrounded yourself with, you know, people that are very smart in different areas that are necessary for your team to function well, but you, I think, are probably a little bit unique than other guests. You have a very strong passion for this subject. And, you know, I know that you and I have spoken about this in the past, but what is it that led you to this opportunity that really consistently fuels the fire for you to work in this space? Like, why, how did value-based kidney care become so near and dear to you?
Yeah. So, I think when we talked before, it's not something I talk about too much, but I've been opening up more and more about it. And I'm happy to share, kind of where a lot of my own passion for just healthcare in general is from. My father growing up was pretty ill. He had his kidney fail when he was in his late 20s. Started dialysis early 30s, had a transplant, got a transplant, failed within a year or two of him getting a transplant, had met my mother and then started on hemodialysis and was fortunate to actually get home hemodialysis. This was late 70s or early 80s. And then ultimately, for a whole host of reasons, myself, my sister, we were born and he kind of stayed at home. And we had a hemodialysis machine that took up half the living room with all the supplies and equipment that took up half the garage. And that was kind of life. It was very normal for me, like just to see my dad go on a dialysis machine 3 times a week, sometimes 4 times a week. By age of 8, I was cannulating his own fistula. I mean, kind of putting the needles in his fistula. Healthcare is not in our family. I'm the only doc in our family. My father was not a whole host of his journey from being an immigrant into this country is one we could probably have an entire hour podcast episode on. For me, it was just being around the healthcare system as a son and a caregiver to my father. And he was on hemodialysis for over 20 something years. And then he had transitioned to another modality of dialysis called peritoneal dialysis for 7 to 8 years. And he ultimately ended up passing away when I was in medical school. And it wasn't predicted. It wasn't something that we anticipated. It was probably something avoidable. So I look at my father's journey and my own kind of journey in healthcare as something that's like, I don't know if this is the best analogy, but like a tale of two cities. It's like it's like one regard is like amazing, like he's been living without kidneys and hasn't created urine for more than half of his existence, and his blood is being filtered and I watch it come out of his body and go back into his body, like absolutely amazing. And when he was younger, he would just go on the machine, then we'd go out and play. But then your body ages, right, faster than you anticipate. You have all these secondary complications that happen. So as he got older, more hospitalizations happened, more complications happened, more cooks in the kitchen, right? Now we had more doctors we had to go to. And again, like not being in a healthcare family, not understanding, right? I started, in retrospect, I could look back to say, oh, that's where it got confused. Oh, that's where this medication was started, but wasn't communicated and wasn't monitored effectively and led to this complication. So then it's only in retrospect and the benefit that I have of being a physician many years later after he's passed away that I can sit down and say, I've always put and I still do, many of his nephrologists and his primary care doc as on a pedestal because they went out of their way to do the best that they could, but they were working in a very fragmented, episodic, reactive healthcare system that is not set up to really help when things get complex. It's great when it's like a simple thing or when it can be a quick fix, like an orthopedic procedure or something like that. But it's the moment you start to get more complex, the more there's more chronic issues, the more then you start to see where the system completely breaks and this system that we set up, it's just not serving the needs. And so I didn't, going into medical school, when he had passed away, I was actually in my third year of medical school. And so I actually had finished out my third year and I just needed to get away and I took a year off. And again, kind of my own curiosity of like, all right, do I really want to go down this path of just doing patient care? I didn't really know exactly what it was pretty devastating when he passed away because he was in many ways my best friend. I would connect with him on a regular basis. I'd stayed at home because as he was getting older, I went to, you know, undergrad and medical school all locally. So I always lived at home. And so, you know, knock on wood, my mother healthy, you know, when he had passed away, I said, you know, let me go explore something else. And so I was fortunate. I got an opportunity to go down to the CDC in Atlanta. And I got an applied epidemiology fellowship. Because again, I had always had that curious bug in me of like, hey, I want to understand these things at a higher macro level. And so when that opportunity opened up, I went down to Atlanta, lived there for a year. Really, you know, I didn't want to do, like, I'm the type where if I have an option to do like a degree, like a versus an actual practical job, I will always pick the practical job over getting yet another degree. So I didn't want to do an MPH, went down, did an applied epidemiology fellowship, got deep into understanding data, the policy, public health infrastructure. And then that led to meeting, you know, the chairman at Duke, where I ultimately went to did residency. He had done a lecture there. We had connected. We had talked about my fourth year. And then that brought me down to North Carolina to do my residency, where I'm still, you know, consulting faculty on to this day. And so that's kind of, you know, his experience and what I went through. It's like, it was just one of those things where it was hard to really understand that, where things broke down until I now much more seasoned, you know, attending, who works with patients. So, but then I got into the primary care world, you know, worked many years, kind of in the outpatient setting, doing patient care. And then I was like, hey, I really enjoy it. Cause I'm not a specialty. Like I don't want to focus in on one thing and just be really good at one thing. Like I'm always, that's why I love primary care. But like 80% of anything that walks through the door, I can address in a confident, competent way. And I love that. And so, you know, at CareMore, you know, where we were kind of the health plan and the provider group, and really pride ourselves on being almost like the cowboy physicians that went rounded in the hospital on our patients, rounded in the nursing homes, saw patients in their homes, saw patients in a clinic, and was able to do care the way I felt like someone like my father would have really benefited from. And so that was kind of the world I was in. Then when this new crop of kind of value, when this evolution of value-based care went, started to go into kind of the specialty care area, quite frankly, like didn't know much about the dysfunction that exists within the how kidney care became the way it is, where so much in-center hemodialysis is at play. You know, it's like when my dad went to dialysis, it was upwards of like 30-35% at the time when he was in was doing home dialysis. It wasn't that abnormal. Now it's like the exact opposite. You know, it's almost 90%+ does in-center hemodialysis, because the last two decades, all of the payment incentives, unit economics, the consolidation of the dialysis industry has driven, you know, much more, you know, focus on the industry versus the patient. And I felt like, you know, now that we're trying to reverse, get more home dialysis, get more transplants, actually try to incentivize to not have a patient start on dialysis to begin with, all of this stuff just made so much sense. And so again, curiosity kind of led me down this path, and fast forward 2 years later, here we are. And there's a whole crop of new companies, which is amazing to see, that's coming into this space, because there's a lot of patients that need help. And, you know, and I think it's great that it's getting the attention it deserves.
Absolutely. We'll be right back after this short break.
That is very incredible, Farhad. And I love the way that you've described that journey, because I think that there's usually something that happens to reinforce or to help help people understand why the work that they do is so meaningful. And I appreciate you sharing that story. But over the course of time, you have seen so many changes within the, you know, from a macro perspective. The healthcare system has gone, you know, more from an acute response to more of a chronic management modality. You've seen technology advance. You've seen new providers enter. You know, so we now have nurse practitioners, physician assistants that are helping in this process. How do you see the healthcare industry changing over the next 5 years or so as it relates to value-based kidney care? I mean, we all know that chronic kidney disease and end-stage renal disease is not going to suddenly start, you know, going down in incidence and you know, the number of patients it's certainly on the rise. But, you know, the technology, the people, the processes, those are all improving. So in 2027, like, what will the world look like when it comes to managing patients with those diseases?
Yeah. So if I'm looking at the lens of just in like what's happening within kidney care, right, CKD, end stage, I think it's pretty clear what our goals are. You know, we need more transplants, right? And ultimately the best way to more or less ensure the highest quality of life for a patient, which also translates to a ton of downstream cost savings to patients, is to get more transplants. And this is transplants preemptively, meaning transplants before a patient ever even has to start dialysis. Ultimately, the best outcomes for patients is when we can do that. Right now, it's about 2% nationwide. A lot more that can be done to improve that. And then transplants, you know, as soon as you can, once the patient starts on dialysis. You know, the longer you're on dialysis, right, the more it's going to take a toll on your body. So more transplants, more home-based dialysis. So for a whole host of reasons, the industry has shifted dramatically away from home-based dialysis. And again, the data is pretty clear. Home-based dialysis is better quality of life for a patient, better outcomes, you know, in many ways. So we need to figure out the right mechanisms to ensure we have safe ways of doing more home-based dialysis. Right now it's about 10% nationwide. Again, when my father, transitioned, it was upwards of 25 to 30. I saw firsthand the convenience that home-based dialysis, he knew his body better than anybody else. He knew when he needed to be dialyzed, how long he needed to be dialyzed for. He learned those things, even though he never understood probably the intricacies of the pathophysiology and the electrolytes. He could tell when things were off, he could tell when things were not off. So home-based dialysis really empowers you as a patient to understand your body better than you could ever do. And just for a whole host of reasons, more home-based dialysis. Much more in general, just proactive care versus reactive care. We kind of talked a little bit about that before, right? The proactive, if somebody is falling off the control of their diabetes and, you know, they're kind of, you know, playing, hey, I'm ashamed to go back to my doctor. I haven't been good about controlling my blood sugars. My A1C is high. I'm just going to ignore it. But it just, you know, hopefully it goes away on its own, you know, and then I'll come to the system when I need to, and you can react to me when I have to chop off your foot because, you know, you have a gangrenous infection in there, right? Like it's, I don't mean that in a joking way, but that's what happens. We lose track of patients and then they come to us way too late. And it's like, I can't reverse your blindness. I can't reverse that amputation. So how do we be more proactive, capture these things as upstream as possible? Because ultimately kidney disease will progress in the shadows of what's happening with uncontrolled blood pressure, uncontrolled diabetes, uncontrolled heart failure. That's putting that pressure, that stress on the kidneys, is compounding it. And so have to be a much more proactive system. And the value-based care really enables that proactivity. And then the other key thing is just safer transitions to dialysis, safer transitions to end stage, I should really say. So sometimes patients are just not going to be great dialysis candidates. And if they are approaching that end stage and they have all these other advanced chronic conditions, they're not going to have great quality of life on dialysis. So knowing how to have a meaningful conversation with patients around advanced care planning, goals of life, quality of life. Often you can have a patient live much longer with, you know, quote unquote end stage kidney disease than ever having to start dialysis and then actually be able to be much more in a driver's seat over their body and what's happening. But then also when patients are 100% appropriate for dialysis, right now, too many patients have unplanned or sometimes what we call crash dialysis starts where, you know, they end up with acute kidney failure on top of their chronic kidney disease in the hospital from a heart failure exacerbation, they have a bunch of fluid, their kidneys are not working as well as they do anymore. All the toxins are building up. So then what do? We throw in a very invasive catheter to start them on emergent dialysis in the hospital. And then often, you know, it takes time for a permanent fistula access to get done, to get placed, to mature, to be able to use. So then that patient now has to use a very dangerous catheter for several months to get dialyzed, which has a whole host of complications, infections. So a lot of, rehospitalizations that happen and a very high risk of dying within 3 months of that transition. So safer transitions to dialysis becomes critical. And how do you do a safe transition? You have to be proactive, right? It all goes back to that proactivity. If you start to see early signs and symptoms that, the kidney reserve is just not keeping up to where it needs to be, despite everything you've been trying to do, you can start to proactively plan, get that fistula placed early, let it mature, give it time, put a PD catheter in, let it adhere and be able to actually slowly start somebody on dialysis over a period of time. And they can avoid the hospital altogether, and they have much better transition. They never have to get an invasive catheter, those types of things. So in the kidney care industry, if we can do some of those things, it will dramatically improve quality of life, dramatically improve patient experience, and improve cost. It's at a point where, it's sad that it's almost so easy to wrap your head around what needs to be done. But it's sad that to wrap your head around what needs to be done, but it's sad that it's so difficult to get it done because of the crazy ecosystem we have within the healthcare industry. So
it's so interesting that you say it the way that you have. And you're right. Like, when we take a step back and we pull ourselves out of that situation, we can examine the environment that we're in and recognize that there are options and solutions and creative ways to be able to solve for them. But then like what you do and what your team does, right? Like creating the workflow, creating the step-by-step protocols of how it can be done and then implementing them. That's usually where the challenge is really, surface as well. Farhad, you've talked to me a little bit about, some of the steps that have led you to where you are today. I'm curious to know, when I take a look at your history, you've worked at and for organizations that, are well established in the past, right? We're talking about, you mentioned the CDC, you've mentioned Duke University Health Systems, even CareMore that was acquired by Anthem, had its own culture and its own, basis before the acquisition. And then, over time, they merged. But working at a startup is it's not a little bit different. It's a lot bit different. What is that like to adjust? And what are some of the challenges that you've experienced going from a well-established, stable, large company to something that's very nimble, very fast, and always on cutting edge? But, what are some of the things that come out of that learning experience that has helped kind of shape the way now that you approach people, processes, and problems? Like, I'd love to hear that process from you.
Yeah, it's one of those situations where you just don't know until you're in it. And the solutions I feel like are, while there's probably good best practices, like they more or less like organically come up as you sit down and unpack. But yeah, I think again, as a Strive, we grew, I don't know, it's a stat, maybe 600% in staff over a period of like even when I joined, we had less than 50 people. And as of, I think this past week, it's probably upwards of 450 people. And I've only been here for a little under 2 years. So it's like, and predominantly in a remote environment and across, a lot of our staff is also just frontline teams that are in Kentucky, in Oregon, in Utah, in Florida, right? So all over the country. So you start to, there's a difference when you're kind of in an office, everybody's there, you're coming in day to day. It's easy to kind of, hey, water cooler talk, right? Connect with people, understand, things that they're working on. Versus here, it's like you have just teams that form and then you get all these like silos that can break out. And then sometimes you have people working on similar things and there's not a good cross, you know, functional collaboration going on because maybe it's just, you don't even know because it's hard. It's like our one-on-one, you know, meeting here and then it ends and then you have another one-on-one. It's like, it doesn't always, the dots don't always, they don't connect automatically. You have to be very intentional about the communication cascade, about, you know, what priorities, how we cross function, what are the working agreements between teams? And so I think some of those things, I don't know if it's unique to a startup, but it's unique to kind of in a remote environment with a growing company. And so I think there's, as we've grown though, we've gotten better, but we've learned. It's been great though. It's like, it's not for everybody. Like if you're the type that needs a very, you know, clear, easy, like this is what I do today type of job. And like, this is what I get. It's probably not the right environment, at least early on. I think we're getting to a better, much more predictable state, but you got to be open. There's going to be things that come up that you have to just sit down and say, all right, hey, let's unpack this. Let's do that. Where do we need to, you know, dive into deeper here? And so I think as we've grown, as we've been scaling up what we're doing, it's been a lot of just surprised by how much time and effort and energy you have to put into that. And it's so worth the investment because then it, if you do that well, if you set up the right, you know, cross-functional collaborative pathways, service level agreements with one another, with teams, you know, the right ways of even setting your goals, you know, from the senior leadership to down to the teams, as long as there's good alignment, then you can start to all work towards a single North Star. Where, you know, where it goes. So I think it's just been surprised by how much of versus like in other environments where, you know, at CareMore, we worked in this, the city of Memphis, Tennessee. We had three care centers. We had three hospitals that we rounded in. We had a team of probably 40 to 50 people at any given moment. But like, I would see everybody every day in person. And so it's like, yes, there's things that happen there, but you ultimately like, pretty easy to kind of get a sense of what's going on here. 450 people. I don't know what anybody's doing at any given moment. Like sometimes it's just my five people in my meeting or six people in this meeting. So like when that meeting ends, like we're working on stuff, but sometimes it's hard. So it's just, and I don't think it's unique to Strive. I think it's just been unique. It's been an interesting, unique challenge in a remote environment, but I feel like it's becoming a great new normal. And as we kind of get more of our norms and cultures established, and it's been good. And the other key thing that comes to mind as I'm talking through this, you know, with the newly formed you know, product team that we created, we also a dear friend of mine actually when we were setting up this team, we were pulling people from all different parts of the org to come into, you know, this team. And he said, hey, go read about Tuckman's new team formation philosophy. It's like when new team formation is, it's a concept of like, you're forming a new team. There's going to be some norming that needs to happen. Then there's going to be storming because there's going to be people that have difference of opinions. And then you ultimately get to performing. So forming, norming, storming, performing. And then need to let every state, you can't bypass forming and then go to performing. You need norming and storming to happen. You need to let, you know, folks figure out how to work best with one another. And that's hard sometimes to see your team storming, right? To having conflict, but it's so instrumental in that process. And so I was really, you know, grateful that I actually studied that concept of a new team forming and how to let that kind of play itself out. Because I feel like we're getting to a place now, you know, at least with my team where we're truly performing. But it wasn't easy to get there. And I feel like that's this kind of environment really created that kind of opportunity to let that happen in a way that was in many ways organically. Because it's just, but once you understand what's driving it, it's fascinating to see.
It is remarkable when you think about team dynamics, especially as a leader, right? Because you certainly want to be able to have everybody, you know, be one cohesive unit working towards the greater good, but everyone is an individual, and then trying to have people with different ideas come to the table with them and then hash it out. Yeah, I've been in a couple of rooms where that doesn't go well, but that is the storming part that helps you get to the norming and the performing. So I do understand and I appreciate that. Farhad, you've had, you know, in my opinion, and I'm sure many other people, like so far, a very, very successful career. You've had some great opportunities to make a meaningful impact, and you continue to do great work both as a clinician and as an executive. Is there somebody in your past that you really feel was instrumental in helping you achieve early success or even recent success? Maybe a mentor or a sponsor that you felt opened doors for you or took you under their wing and gave you encouragement, advice, and just, you know, basic, you know, opportunities that you would like to acknowledge on the show for their graciousness and their time.
Yeah, wow. I mean, it's like too many to count. you know, and I feel like I was listening to one of your other podcast episodes. Actually, a former colleague, Sumer, was talking. He said, you know, it sounds cliche, but his parents sacrificed, you know. And that resonated very much with me when on his response on that. I think for being a first generation immigrant here, especially kind of the unique challenges that I saw with my dad's health condition, but even my mom working two jobs, you know, really helping to kind of make sure everything remains normal, despite it totally not being as normal as when you look back, like, oh, okay. But just seeing the level of, you know, commitment, dedication to family, to myself, my sister, our education, really impact. Like, it just, again, it's one of those, as a, you know, I'm almost 40 years old. I look back and I'm like, wow, now I get it. I have kids on my own now. And I get it. I get it. The sacrifices, the commitments, like, that's real. And I can only, just begin to wrap my head around what that really meant for them. So I truly feel like they laid that foundation. And I viewed my own career as, you know, it's never about me. It's about, like, what am I doing that's for the betterment of humanity in many ways. And whenever I adapt that mindset, like, it's like, don't go. I'm one to chase a title. I'm never one to chase a paycheck. I want to make sure I'm doing work that is I'm going to get up and be excited about, but it's also just about people and improving, you know, those that maybe don't have the same access or knowledge base or understanding of how it could be better, right? Like, we could, like, let's challenge the status quo of healthcare and really try to get it, you know, moving in the right direction and make that meaningful. It's not about you. It's about the betterment of kind of society. So I don't know. I think those things, it got instilled in me on, like, just seeing my mom sacrifice about, like, it's not about me. It's about the family. And my dad's, you know, he was the type that never, despite all the pain and suffering that he went through, never showed it. It was always about, hey, I want to make sure that the family is not just, you know, drowning in my own pain and sorrow here. I want to make sure I'm always keeping a positive attitude and upbeat personality. And really making sure that they feel like this is a loving, caring home. So I don't know, sounds cliche, but my parents first and foremost. And then I've just been lucky to have, you know, I found a partner with my wife who's been so, you know, by my side for many years now, two lovely children, and all that stuff grounds you in many ways. And yeah, I have a very loving, caring sister who's really kind of been a mentor for me. You know, cause I just followed her. Like, I went to the same, she went to Rutgers. I went to Rutgers. She did biology. I did biology. She told me what classes to take. I took it. Like, I listened every step of the way. She, you know, kept me on a great path, and I wouldn't have been successful in college. I know it for a fact if she didn't guide me in that way. And if you're not successful in college, you're not getting to medical school. Right. So there's those bricks that get laid that, you look back and like, hey, that now it's, people have laid that foundation. Now, what do I do with it? you know, what are what's the path I'm going to carve out here, and how can I give that back to the people, you know, and help other people get to a place I've always been very intentional about, when it, especially if somebody reaches out or wants any kind of mentorship or guidance, or, you know, I drop what I'm doing and try to go out of my way to offer any kind of support and guidance that I can give. So,
well, that's good. And I appreciate that for that. That's, you know, I think a lot of times people forget how one or two people really just change the trajectory of how we view, you know, our own goals. And the people that support us in that way, intentionally, unintentionally, like whether they do it directly as a parent, or just something that you observed. And it's like, you know, that's a good best practice. I'm going to adopt that. And it really makes that difference. You know, let's go back for a moment, because we were talking about like the team and storming, forming, storming, norming, and performing. You know, as a leader with a group of 20 on your team, like that's, as you pointed out, like some of these individuals, they're all like in remote areas of the country, and having that relationship being built with them. It's a challenge now, not just because it's a startup, but because post-pandemic world, you know, it's just different. But, you know, still as a leader, you have that responsibility to help them either find new opportunities, gain new skills, and really fine tune their leadership skills so that maybe they're ready for the next project, you know, position, whatever that might be. What sort of resources do you rely on, either for yourself or for your team? Maybe it's a book, a video, a speaker, an author that you recommend to others for their leadership development or just personal growth in general?
Since I've been in leadership roles for the last several years, I feel like I've Eric, here you go. Just regular old Harvard Business Review. Like great resources. I find they take kind of the latest you know, science around how to best perform as a team, how to, right? So I anchor a ton on reading different articles to get the ideas, and I love sharing it with team when I feel like it speaks to maybe a certain challenge or issue we're having. So definitely that. In terms of like just things of my own kind of what's resonated with my own leadership style, Brené Brown, I feel like, is having a moment right now with kind of this power embracing of vulnerability, and really kind of it's creating a just new age type of leadership that definitely feels so much more natural to me. I feel like, especially, and maybe this is a little bit of a tangent, but like we have such a, like a toxic masculine culture, right? Like, and vulnerability is almost looked at as a weakness in many ways, you know? And so I think she's really changing that paradigm in many ways, and thinking about how do you embrace vulnerability. You know, she has a great podcast. I listen to it all the time, but I also just finished her mini series that she has on HBO about emotional granularity, and really unpacking, you know, when you need to just embrace and feel certain types of emotions. I feel like it goes in line with self-awareness, you know, and those are kind of critical to for me to be successful. Hey, if you're feeling a certain way, don't type that email yet. Just stop, do it tomorrow. All right. Cause you see that sometimes, and I've been victim of that. Sometimes you're so reactive in the moment. I just want to get it out. Like, I feel like I need to get it off my chest, but then it goes out into the world. Like, ooh, that didn't, like in 2 days later, you look back like, ouch, like that. I said that. Right. So, but those are, she had a great thing about, it's like a survey of thousands of people she did, or some experiment they were doing. Like, people on average in a given day felt joy, anger, or pissed off. Joy, happiness, sadness, or pissed off. Like, those are the three emotions that people feel on a regular basis. But she's like, there's hundreds of other emotions but we got to a point in society where it's like, all we know is we're happy, we're sad, or we're pissed off. And that's not, there's no granularity there, right? It's so unpacking anyway, Brené Brown, Tony Robbins, you know, I feel like he's kind of an oldie, but a goodie. He's somebody I've followed for several years. I just love his passion and his energy, and just how he unpacks, you know, certain aspects of how to think about, you know, your past trauma, how that might be informing what's happening now, and just reorienting, you know, a frame of mind that I feel like is, it just, every time I hear it, or I see it, or I read it, it resonates. But yeah, I think those are some of my personal ones. And then I feel like those are some of the things that kind of guide my own philosophy in many ways.
All right, I'm going to ask, did you ever walk on fire? Did you ever attend a Tony
Robbins
event?
No, I never did. That stuff is too expensive. I never went down. He charges a lot of money to go.
I have a couple of friends that did it, and they've walked on fire. And I'm like, that's insane. But they paid a pretty penny to get there too.
Yeah. I've never done that, but I just enjoy it. His I'm Not Your Guru documentary on Netflix. That was really eye-opening. I enjoyed that, but yeah, I never did the actual live event.
Interesting. Farhad, when you're looking at, you know, a person, whether they're on your team or considering joining your team, like, there are certain things as an interviewer, as a leader, a hiring manager, that, you know, you're looking for fit. Right? It could be cultural fit, individual fit, but that person has to bring something to the table in the conversation and an interview that helps strike the balance between what they can provide and where you can add, you know, input to them to help them become, you know, the right piece for your puzzle. You know, what are some of the, I'd say this, like, what are the three qualities or characteristics that you look for in an individual when you're considering them either for a position on your team or for promoting them onto something bigger and better?
Yeah, I feel like probably a constant theme in my conversation with you right now, curiosity, right? I don't know if you watched Ted Lasso show, but he had that one scene about, like, don't be judgmental, be curious. I feel like it's so simple, but you start to unpack that in your day-to-day life, and it's like, oh, I could easily be judgmental here, but let me just unpack a little bit. Curious, I love curiosity. Self-awareness, again, kind of the theme of Brené Brown, vulnerability, understanding your own strengths, weaknesses, but also with a growth mindset. Like, never get comfortable, never get to a point where you think you know it all or figure it all out. Like, always, how can I improve? You know, someone who's not afraid to give and receive meaningful, constructive feedback, whether good or in the bad, but in a constructive way to grow. And then, yeah, I guess the other thing I think is, what is, like, do you have an ethical core? You know, what are your values? Making sure that, you know, you're trying to do this for the right right reasons. You're thinking about it in the lens of, you know, again, how do I ensure what I'm doing is, you know, not kind of going into a territory of just trying to manipulate something, or right, to, for my own betterment. Like, so I think, you know, those are some key qualities I guess I usually end up kind of looking for. Hard to always tease out in an interview process. Much easier once you're working with somebody, kind of know, you know, how they are. But there's definitely ways that you can ask questions that just see where people's minds are at, and thinking through stuff like that. So I think that's kind of, those are the key things I look for.
Very valuable. Farhad, you've been an amazing individual. You've shared so many great ideas, initiatives, insights. What's the last or final piece of advice or information you'd like to share with the listeners today that maybe we haven't touched on yet?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like one thing I've also started to do recently is read more fiction. Kind of sounds a little bit different, but I feel like we sometimes just understanding how to walk in somebody's shoes, empathy, you know, whether it's with a colleague, with a patient, and really kind of being there for them, and it can't come without empathy, and you can get more empathy when you actually read or embrace more kind of works of fiction, understand stories that you're not comfortable or familiar with. Recently just been reading about a story of a Danish man who was a refugee from Afghanistan, and seeing his journey and his family's journey. And he was a gay man who's, so it's like a life experience that's completely foreign for me, but I'm seeing it through the lens of his work, it just really gave me another sense of like, when I, if I come across, you know, a situation where somebody has maybe similar lived experience, life experience, now I just have another level of empathy that I would have never been exposed to if I wasn't curious enough to kind of dig into this work. Because you're not always going to be fortunate enough to have meaningful, intimate, deep conversations. But I find these artists that put their soul into these works of fiction to tell their story in such a beautifully crafted way, to just, when you spend some time with that work, it helps you I feel like it unlocks different pathways in my brain that I just never didn't have before. So a very strange deviation of where we are, but I don't know. I feel like it's something I've been embracing more as I get older, but I feel like I probably it would have been much more valuable if I embraced as I'm younger too, if I started earlier or as I was younger. So
Farhad, thank you again for being a guest on the Healthcare and Higher podcast. I'm very excited that you were here. I see that there's so many great things that Strive Health is doing, and you're going to continue to be a part of that, helping the company grow. I'm excited, and I'm wishing you a lot of success, and I'm excited to see how you continue to take healthcare to a higher level.
Excellent. Thank you, Paul. Really appreciate it. Hopefully we cross paths again soon.
Thanks for joining me on this episode of the Healthcare and Higher podcast. If you liked what you heard, be sure to follow and subscribe for more. I'm your host, Iqbal Acha, and I invite you to connect with me on LinkedIn, Instagram, and Twitter. Let me know what you thought about this episode or my show in general. Also, visit me at www.achainternational.com to learn more about how I help healthcare professionals and healthcare leaders advance their career, build a better brand, and create a leadership legacy. I'll be back next week with another episode. But until then, let's keep working to take healthcare to a higher level.